A child's inquisitive nature is a fascinating thing. It can also be very disconcerting. Who of us has not left an afternoon with a four-year-old impressed by his machine gun questions, his whys, ever-recurrent whys about everything in the world which surrounds him, impressed by his eagerness to learn, but equally embarrassed in that if an adult had asked us the same questions, we recognize we could not have given precise or accurate answers to each of these very elemental things about which the child inquired. Now, our inquisitive nature is one of our most precious divine gifts. It is one of the things which separates man from the brute. The animal accepts and adapts. Man asks and analyzes and seeks to turn the world without to his own benefit. It is our asking why as a child which gives us our adult know-how. It is the why asked in the childhood of the race which changes and transforms the savage or illiterate through the centuries into the learned scientist. Now, as with the child, so the child man at the dawn of history was fascinated by the world about him. The earliest literature extant, the Hindu Vedas, the Egyptian mysteries, the Babylonian myths, are filled with protein scientific explanations, answers to the whys asked by the people of the world about him. Now, these answers are for the most part completely inaccurate and unacceptable. And yet they evidence the first outreaching of man into that frightening world of darkness which surrounds him. And out of these first tentative pseudo-scientific answers, that vast, wonderful pyramid of science was built in which we rejoice today. The book of Genesis, the biblical book of beginnings, contains many of these early attempts to answer the whys of the child man. In the book of Genesis, we learn why the week has 7 days, why the stars cannot be seen in the daylight, why the rainbow follows the storm, why pain accompanies childbirth, why the snake is the only land animal which lacks feet, many other such intriguing answers. And again, we must reject in each case the science in which the answer is phrased. But since most of these answers are the result of a religious quest rather than of scientific research, they often do contain a germ of intellectual truth still valid in our own day. Thus, the explanation of the dissymmetry of our rib cage, the explanation that God took one of our ribs and out of the rib of man fashioned the woman. Now, anatomically, this is implausible and impossible. But ethically and philosophically, have we not here the germ of an important idea that a woman must sculpt the substance of her marriage and her life out of the interests, out of the profession, out of the activities of her husband. She is as if she is part of his own flesh. She fulfills herself as she helps him fulfill himself. And would not a great deal of the current marital unhappiness be abated and assuaged if many would look carefully at this early scientific explanation in our Bible and take it to heart? And the Bible is not a book of science. The book of Genesis was never intended to be dogmatic in matters which are scientific. Otherwise, how can we explain the fact that side by side in the book of Genesis there occur two varying, different, and divergent accounts of creation? In the first account, man is the last item of creation. The first account is manifestly set down to establish the Sabbath, the holiness, the taboo, the sanctity of the Sabbath. The first piece of labor legislation known to man. In the second account, creation takes place not in six stages, but in ten. Man is not the last item of creation, but indeed all the other animals are created after man, and woman is the final act of creation. The second account is manifestly an attempt to raise woman to a position in society and thought equal to that of man. She was considered in the Near East as little more than a household slave. And this was the first of the suffragette tracts ever written in history. We have these two divergent accounts. And unless we presume that the biblical editors lacked eyes and lacked understanding, and who, having read the Bible, can presume to doubt their understanding and their wisdom, we must presume that they knew their science to be inadequate, or at least tentative, that they made no attempt to state their science as dogma, but rather that they were interested in using a scientific framework to establish certain theological truths. And if we were to take the first account of creation, and if we were to transpose it into terms acceptable to Einstein and to Eddington, I wonder if we would have added a single iota of truth to the truth which lies in this 4,000-year-old text. We would still see God the first cause, God the creative power, God who orders the wonderful machinery and vastness and majesty of the universe. We would still see God creating in man certain capacities of these psyche and of the heart which separate man forever from the beast. We would still see God creating a world verdant and abundant, capable of sustaining a healthy and happy society. We would still see the obligation and challenge imposed upon man to so regulate and discipline his lusts and his greed and his animal nature as to establish that society which God wills. This is the elemental scheme of creation, of the creation story in the Bible. And the truth implicit in this text is in no wise changed if we assume modern physics and the modern biological theories of evolution, or presume these awkward, ancient, first tentative postulates as to the physics and the biology of creation. We ought not to read the Bible in terms of scientific dogma, because such reading has led both believer and disbeliever into error. The believer presumes often that the Bible contains truth, all truth, and then he is led to hold on to inaccurate, erroneous scientific principles long after these have been disproved by the observatory and by the laboratory. Clarence Darrow, in his now famous Scopes trial, was fighting against such a community of believers. But equally, the disbeliever often reads this antique science, and he says how utterly unsophisticated and untrue it is, and then he presumes to judge the whole purpose of the Bible as antique and outdated and not worth the effort of the reading. As if we would downgrade the great masterpieces of our museums because so many of them hang in these gilded, garish frames with which they were covered in the 19th century. The truth of the Bible lies deep within the text. It is affected not one iota by the truth or the inaccuracy of the scientific framework which it is sometimes given by these early biblical authors. Well, if the book of Genesis is not a collection of just-so stories, and if it is not a textbook of science, what is it? Some have said that it is a textbook of history, that it is the Jewish accounting, the chronicle of the history of man from creation and the history of the Jewish people from the time of Abraham through the age of the patriarchs. And indeed, the book of Genesis does have a chronological framework. It begins with creation, Adam and Eve, the story of Cain and Abel, the 10 generations between creation and the flood, 10 generations between Noah and Abraham, and then continues with the stories of Abraham and of his sons and of his grandsons and of his great-grandsons until Joseph and his brothers bring the whole household of Israel down into Egypt, where they are ultimately enslaved. This is the continuity of the book of Genesis. But as the author of Genesis made no claim to its scientific accuracy, it is my feeling that he made no claim as to its historical factuality. There are, for instance, in the book of Genesis, divergent accounts of the same incident. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are each accused of having done the same damage to the reputation of their wives. Some of the early generations are said to have lived to an absurdly old age. And these accounts are set down by men whom we know from other evidence in the Bible could be and were supremely competent historians. If you read the book of Samuel, if you read the book of Kings, if you read the book of Chronicles, you know that you stand there in the presence of men who could and did write good history. And since we know from the style of Genesis that its editing makes it one of the last of the books of the Bible, we must presume that these Jewish sages knew the meaning of historical accuracy, the importance of being precise in one's fact, the importance of leaving out inaccuracies, incongruities. Imagine a good historian telling the story of creation, creating Adam, creating Eve, seeing to it that they had sons, three sons, Cain and Abel and Seth, but failing to tell us entirely how it comes into being that there are women in the world, wives for these boys to marry, hence to populate through their families the face of the globe. These women are simply presumed in the Bible. Presumed because the biblical author was not interested in writing for us and setting down for us an historical, accurate document of this prehistory of man. It is my position and my feeling that the history of Genesis is merely the peg upon which the authors of the book of Genesis set down their purpose. And what is their purpose? Their purpose is to encapsulate in story form, in a form which will delight the mind, which will sensitize the imagination, which will capture the interest, the basic philosophic and theological first principles of Judaism. The book of Genesis is, in its surface and in its depth, one of the most pregnant, one of the most suggestive, one of the most important of all the books of the Bible. It is history raised to philosophy. It is legend raised and embroidered till it becomes some of the most provocative literature ever written. Take the story of the murder of Abel by Cain. Here is an outpouring of anger against one of the most heinous of fratricides ever perpetrated. These 11 verses in which the Bible tells this story are pointed and have a punch and are poignant. But are they only to tell us that the Bible disapproves of murder? Ten Commandments states this quite simply. It is obvious that our moral religion would disapprove of such a crime. And indeed, if we read the story of Cain and Abel carefully, we see within the text both a moral indignation which is to be expected and a new dramatic philosophy of law, which is totally unexpected, because Cain murders Abel, and what is to be the punishment of Cain? God says, thou shalt be an outcast, a pariah, a wanderer upon the face of the globe. And Cain complains to God and says, surely they will stone me where they see me. I will not survive. And God says, cursed be the one who raises his hand or his sword to you. God implicitly here is underlying the importance of avoiding clan vengeance, which was the only type of law known in the ancient Near East. The Montagues against the Capulets, blood for blood, life for life. There are to be courts. Society must interpose its instruments between the criminal and the victim and the clan of the victim. And all of Jewish life is an attempt to establish the authority of such courts, and a system of punishments and of evidence which they can develop. And here God, by his cursing of any would-be murderer of Cain, establishes as a first principle of our faith that no individual is to arrogate the law to himself, to take the law into his own hands. The law and punishment are to be instruments of the society, not of an individual, not of a family. This is the meaning. This is the purpose why this very dramatic, simple story, this first murder in mankind's history, is told in our Bible. This week in our synagogues, the story is being read of the old age of Abraham. Abraham is full of years, full of the respect of his family, of his tribe, of the tribes among whom he lives. He has known success, he has found wealth, he has known love, he has rejoiced in a large family. He knows that his days are drawing to their close, and only one thread in the skein of life remains unraveled. His son Isaac is not yet married. He has not yet established himself in life. And Abraham, according to our Bible, calls to his bedside his most faithful servant, the steward of his household, and he asks the steward to undertake for him a mission. He is to return to the ancestral home in Syria, Nahor, and there among the near relatives of Abraham find a suitable wife for his son Isaac. He does not wish Isaac to take a wife from the neighboring tribes because they are idolaters, worshippers of images, and he is afraid that Isaac will be contaminated by the worship of his wife and by the superstition and the magic of idolatry and the new religion, Judaism, which he has come to and in which he believes will be destroyed and be perverted by such a marriage. The servant undertakes the mission. Now, on the surface of it, the story is creditable. 4,000 years ago, Abraham, the first Jew, might indeed have called his servant to him and asked him to undertake such a mission. But there is obviously a second level, a political level, to the story. In the days of the kings of Israel, 1,500 years after the days of Abraham, one of the greatest threats to our faith came through intermarriage. For reasons of treaty, for political reasons, the kings often intermarried with princesses from neighboring countries and tribes. And these princesses brought into the court of Solomon, into the court of Jehu, into the court of Ahab, into the court of Hezekiah, their foreign cults and their foreign priests and their superstitious and magical ways. And time and again, the prophets of Israel had to purify Judaism, purify the people, purify the temple sanctuary from the idolatrous cults and beliefs which these princesses had introduced. And here some late writer is saying to the kings of Israel, as Abraham, your progenitor, the first Jew, was concerned with marrying within his own, so avoid foreign entanglements which can destroy and overwhelm the pristine quality of your own new faith. Be true to your faith, even in your marriage. But there's a second and perhaps more universal and spiritual meaning to this story. If you were commissioned to find a wife for the son of a beloved friend, how would you go about it? What standards would you undertake? What measurements would you feel the bride had to fulfill? Well, this was the problem that faced the steward of Abraham's household. He went to Nahor, and one could almost read his mind. Shall he go to the Central National Bank of Nahor and ask for the bank account of each of the leading families of the city and choose a wife whose father had the most substantial bank book? Certainly this is done. Shall he go to Nahor and convoke a beauty contest of all the damsels of the city? Shall he choose the most beautiful girl as the most suitable wife for Isaac? Shall he go to Nahor and hold a quiz program? Will the most brilliant girl in the city be the most suitable wife for Isaac? Beauty, brains, wealth, Are these the standards of a suitable marriage? And this servant, who unfortunately is anonymous to us, but was certainly a brilliant man, struck upon a device, a stratagem as successful as it was simple. You'll recall that he goes to Nahor, but he does not enter the city gates. He stops before the well from which the water for drinking and for bathing is drawn. He knows it is the common shore for the women, for the young daughters of the household, each dawn and each dusk to come out of the city, their large earthen pitchers, to draw water for the evening meal and for their bath. And he will ask of each of these girls in turn if they will draw water for him, if they will pause in their routine long enough to do a favor for a stranger. And that girl who will not only pause to draw water for the stranger, but who will volunteer to draw water for his retinue and for even for his camels, she will be the suitable wife for Isaac. Character, helpfulness, unselfishness. Certainly these are elemental qualities in a successful marriage. Certainly we have one of the finest of marriage sermons which could possibly be preached. There is an ethical level to each of these Bible tales. There is a political level to many of these tales. And there is the surface level, the seeming literal history told of our most ancient peoples. In many ways, the book of Genesis reminds me of Alice in Wonderland. Like Alice, it is full of brilliant imagery. It captures the imagination. You can hardly put it down. Like Alice, there is meaning upon meaning. The child reads Alice as a fairy tale. He enjoys the action, the color, the movement of the people. The adult reads Alice for the same reason, but he recognizes in Alice in Wonderland a gentle lampooning of the characteristics of London society in the Victorian age. And the erudite English scholar reads Alice, knowing that every movement of every character represents the movements of chess pieces on a chessboard. That Lewis Carroll wrote this book against the framework of a carefully calculated and contrived chess game. Now, the book of Genesis is more sensitive, sounder, and more suggestive than the book of Alice in Wonderland. Yet they both share this multi-level meaning. They both delight the eye, delight the imagination. Who can forget the story of the Garden of Eden, which I read to you this morning? Who can forget the story of Joseph's coat of many colors and how he is sold by his brothers into slavery in Egypt, and then of the great scene of reconciliation where Joseph, now raised to the second command in all of Egypt, allows his petitioning brothers to come to him and to be reconciled and united again with him. These are colorful scenes, scenes which once learned the child and the child adult never forgets. There is much more, much that is more profound and deeper to the Bible than that. And it is for these reasons that we treasure it and call it sacred. A child rejoices in the coloring of the animals as they march into the ark. An adult remembers the ice age and the floods which attended its conclusion, and he sees in the story of Noah some distant memory of that age. The thinker, the philosopher, is impressed not so much by the flood as by the rainbow, by God's promise never again to bring total destruction upon the world. And he sees in this promise two things. First, Judaism's determination to free man from any fear of the gods. The Greeks feared their gods. Their gods could at whim and at will interfere in their lives, bring on war as the Trojan War, bring on enmity between cities, bring on a curse or fate against which they could only rail. And what was true of the Greeks was true of the Babylonians, was true of the Persians, was true of the Indians, was true of the Egyptians. Only Judaism insisted that God will not at will interfere for reasons beyond man's control in the affairs of the world. Man has given life, and in giving life, he has given to us a challenge. We must fulfill this challenge. If we fail, we can destroy the world, but God, for reasons of his own, will never again wantonly destroy it. And in the rainbow, and in the contract God makes at the end of the flood, there is the basis of all science. The ancients, believing that the gods could interfere at will in the world, could not see the world in terms of natural law, of cause and effect, of an orderly progression of causes. But in the contract made with man, with Noah, God promises him that as long as the world survives, seed time and harvest, summer and winter, the heat and the cold shall continue. And here is the first tentative philosophy of science, that there is a basic orderliness to the universe, an orderliness in which God himself does not interfere, an orderliness which can be studied by man, an orderliness which man can exploit to his own benefit. And the Greeks seized upon this Jewish idea and brought it into fruition. The idea, the first statement of science, is Jewish and found in our own book of Genesis. But what is particularly to me, and with this I conclude, was particularly impressive of the book of Genesis is its doctrine of man. Not only here do we find the fountainhead of the idea that all men are brothers, have we not all one father, hath not one God created us? Adam and Eve, one pair, out of that pair all men, all races. Out of the three sons of Noah, the Bible again explicitly underlines the three great races that they knew, the Hamitic and the Semitic and the Greek, stem. All men are equal in birth, though they might not be equal in life. Judaism alone of the ancient religions emphasized the castelessness and the classlessness of humanity. Other ancient peoples believed that they, the natives, were sons of demigods. The barbarian, the heathen, were no better than the animal. Only Judaism, only our Bible, only the book of Genesis saw the common humanity, the common frailty, the mortality which unites us all. But more brilliant even than this insight is the insight the book of Genesis gives us to ourselves. We tend, as the ancients tend, to think of the world and to think of man in terms of opposites. Heavenly, heaven-inspired, God-kissed saint, the black-hearted sinner. We see no opposites. We see none of the infinite shadings in between. The book of Genesis tells us that the inclinations of man are evil from his youth. And the book of Genesis tells us equally that man is created in the image of God. There is lust in man, and there is love. There is greed in man, and there are altruistic tendencies. There is self-centeredness, the ego, and there is a desire to serve men. The heroes of our people, the first heroes, the patriarchs, are whole men. Jacob begins as a cunning, conniving, contriving adolescent, bound to the apron strings of his mother, despoiling his brother of a birthright which was rightly his. Joseph begins as a pampered, overly sheltered youth, impossible to live with, arrogant beyond belief. What is great in these men is not that they were born to nobility, born with exceptional character, but that in life and through life they matured into the kind of people whom we can admire. And isn't that true of every life? None of us are born perfect. None of us are born whole. None of us are born complete in all of our emotional and character parts. In each of us there is at war weakness, courage, faith and cynicism, doubt and certainty. Our whole life is a battle between these opposites, a tension which is really never resolved. The great man, the fine individual, the person whom we respect, is not perfect from birth to death and perhaps certainly never perfect. But he is the man who somehow overcomes his weaknesses, overcomes his doubts, overcomes his indulgence, and makes of himself, disciplines himself in the outstanding citizen and individual. Perhaps the greatest story of all in the book of Genesis lasts only four lines. It is told of Jacob who had stolen the birthright of his brother, who had fled from his ancestral home, who had worked, as you will recall, with a near relative, Laban, who had fallen in love in Laban's household with his young daughter, Rachel, who had signed a contract with Laban that he would work with him for 7 years, and after the 7 years, Laban must give him his daughter as wife, who was deceived by Laban in that the veiled bride brought to his tent on his marriage night was the elder sister, Leah. Jacob, who worked then another 7 years for his first love, Rachel, and married her, and who some 20 years after the errors of his youth, after the sins against his brother, determines in his heart that he must make peace with Esau, that he must return to Canaan to be reunited with his brother. He takes his household, his possessions, his wives, and he begins the trek from Syria by caravan to Canaan. But those whom we have wronged, we fear. And Jacob was uncertain as to his welcome. Esau was strong. Esau was powerful. Esau might fight with him and destroy him. And all one night, you will recall, the night before the meeting, Jacob wrestles with himself. The Bible symbolizes this as a wrestling with an angel. Jacob wrestles with his weaker selves, the promptings of his uncertainty. Return. Turn back before it is too late. Give in. Why do you expose yourself, Jacob, to danger? Is a uniting of yourself with your brother so important that you are risking your life for it? And Jacob wrestles the whole night. And the angel wounds Jacob, as we are always scarred by life. From then on, you recall, he limps in his thigh. But Jacob wrestles the whole night with himself, with his angel, and he emerges victorious. And the angel changes his name. No longer shall ye be called Jacob the deceiver. From now on, you shall be called Israel, he who strives with God. All of subsequent Jewish history is an attempt by the people of Israel to be worthy of their name. Is an attempt of men and women born frail and mortal to make and discipline their lives so as to be of service to God, of service to their fellow men, and as to bring pride to their family and to themselves. It is no easy matter to become a son of Israel, a worthy descendant of the first Israel. But the book of Genesis charts for us the way. It shows us the struggle in all of its dimensions. It shows us the possibility. It counsels us to take as heroes, not gods whom we cannot emulate, but men with all of their frailties and all of their accomplishments whom we can. Our Book of Beginnings is a great book. I highly commend it to you in this season when it is being read in synagogues throughout the world.